This is Ni'ima Novetsky from alatorad.org. As Pesach approaches, this Torah cast will explore one of the most fundamental questions related to the holiday. Why was the Egyptian exile necessary? We spend Seder night praising Hashem for freeing us from Egyptian bondage. But why did Hashem ordain that we be exiled and enslaved to begin with? In Tanakh, suffering on a large scale, such as exile or subjugation, usually comes as punishment for evil deeds. But what sin was committed that was egregious enough to justify such a severe punishment? And who committed this crime? The Torah itself neither explicitly records any particular sin that caused this degree, nor blames any particular individual or group, suggesting perhaps that there was none. However, if the exile and oppression were not punitive, what purpose did the suffering serve? Trials and tribulations are often understood to be educative, a means of inculcating values or instilling faith. Yet if this was Hashem's goal, could he not have accomplished it without causing such terrible suffering? Given these questions, is it possible that the descent to Egypt and subsequent events were simply a result of the nation's own volition and not a product of divine intervention at all? A second set of questions relates to the covenant of the pieces, Hashem's covenant with Avraham, in which the exile, oppression, and ultimate redemption were foretold. Why did Hashem feel compelled to share such a terrifying prophecy with Avraham, especially if it was only to come to fruition two generations later? Hashem's prophecy combined two related decrees, the exile of Ger Yiyeh Zarecha and the oppression of Va'avadum Ve'inu Otam. These two events, though, affected different generations. The generation of Yosef and his brothers was exiled, but no member of that generation suffered through the much later oppression. Might this suggest that the various stages of the decree had different goals which were aimed at different generations? Commentators ponder these questions, offering a variety of possible explanations for the decrees. In exploring the issue, many commentators draw on their own experience in exile, using the Egyptian experience as a prism through which to view the exile and suffering of their own times. In essence, they ask not just, why was the exile and oppression in Egypt necessary, but why is it that b'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chalotenu? Why in every generation is the Jewish nation singled out for persecution? Perhaps the most prevalent approach to our question is to suggest that the exile and enslavement must have been punishment for sin. Commentators, though, disagree about whose sin was the ultimate cause of the suffering and what was the nature of that sin. Several commentators fault Abraham, assuming that if he was the person who received the decree of punishment, he must be to blame. As such, Shmuel in Bavli Nedarim blames Avraham for displaying a lack of faith in Hashem when he requested a sign that he would inherit the land, asking, "Bama ida ki irashena." It seems that this choice of sin is textually motivated, as this is the last episode that takes place before the decree of enslavement is foretold in the Covenant of the Pieces. It's natural to suggest that it is the cause. Furthermore, if Avraham doubted his rights to the land, then a decree of exile from the land is a fitting punishment. Ramban, in contrast, suggests that the offense was Avraham's decision to go down to Egypt in the time of the famine, endangering Sarah as he did so. Ramban finds support for his theory in the many parallels between the story of Avraham and Sarah in Egypt and the sojourn of the Israelites in Egypt. In both, famine leads people to Egypt where they are oppressed, but then the oppressors are punished by plague, and the victims leave with much wealth. Ramban, like Shmuel and the Bavli, views the decree as a measure-for-measure punishment. Avraham did not have sufficient faith to stay put in the promised land, so later his descendants were to be exiled from it. Ramban's opinion fits with his general position that Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim, the actions of the patriarchs established the patterns and templates which charted the course of history for their descendants. The Torah itself, however, does not identify any of these actions of Avraham as sins, leaving ample room for debate whether any should be regarded as such. And even if they were somewhat problematic, it's still questionable whether the punishment was proportionate to the crime. The 15th century Spanish commentator Rav Yitzhak Arama further questions whether this approach is not antithetical to the Torah's doctrine that only the sinner himself is punished. If Avraham sinned, why did he deserve to live out his life in peace while his descendants suffered the consequences of his actions? Due in part to these questions, Rav Arama's contemporary, Abarbanel, prefers to blame the exile on the brother's sale of Yosef. According to his approach, the very people who sin are the ones who are exiled. He notes the many similarities between the stories, highlighting how the punishment fits the crime. The brothers sell Yosef into slavery in Egypt, and so their descendants are enslaved in the very same place. Just as the brothers had attempted to kill Yosef by throwing him into the pit, baby boys are later thrown into the Nile. A bloodied goat helped the brothers cover up their deed, and so later, a bloody sheep, the Paschal sacrifice, acts as atonement. As kidnapping and selling a person is a capital crime, the brothers were deserving of harsh punishment. Nonetheless, Abarbanel must still grapple with the question of why the generation which sinned got off relatively easily, being exiled but not enduring the oppression and slavery, while it was the innocent subsequent generations which suffered through the harsher stages of the punishment. Abarbanel responds that sometimes children continue to suffer the natural consequences of the punishment which their parents received. One might further question why the decree was foretold already to Avraham if he played no part in the sin and was not to witness the punishment. Abarbanel explains that the prophecy about the Egyptian exile was a parenthetical comment, necessary only in order to explain to Avraham the delay in the inheritance of the land. Thus Hashem mentioned only the punishment and not the sin. The Akedat Yitzchak brings a third question on this approach, pointing out that the decree of exile preceded the sin of the sale of Yosef. How can punishment be decreed for a crime not yet committed? Abarbanel replies that this is not the only case of punishment being predicted before sins are committed. Devarim 31 and 32 contain a whole list of dire predictions that will serve to punish the nation, even though they had not yet sinned to deserve them. One might argue, however, that those chapters also list the future sins to be committed, and can thus be construed as general warnings or conditional decrees intended to prevent the nation from disobeying the commandments of Hashem. Our chapter, in contrast, appears to be an absolute divine decree with a specific time frame, not a warning against sin. These questions lead to yet a third variation of this punitive approach, which suggests that the blameworthy party is neither Avraham, who is foretold of the punishment, nor the brothers who were exiled, but rather the Israelites themselves who were enslaved in Egypt. In other words, the generation which sinned was also the generation which was enslaved. Midrash Tanchuma suggests that the nation had ceased performing the rites of circumcision, likely choosing this mitzvah as the one transgressed because it was the only commandment given as a covenant with Avraham's descendants. Radak similarly suggests that the nation had assimilated in Egypt, but points to verses in Yechezkel 20 to suggest that they had turned to idolatry. This position must contend with some of the same issues as the previous one. How can punishment be decreed before crimes are committed? In addition, though it easily explains how those who were enslaved deserved their punishment and were not being punished for sins of their parents, it leaves open the opposite question. Why were the earlier generations, which did not sin, forced into exile? Thus, perhaps the simplest solution would be to combine this sub-approach with the previous one, and to suggest that the exile was a punishment for the sin of Yosef's brothers, while the bondage was a punishment for the Israelites' sin in Egypt. This entire approach, that afflictions must be punishment for sin, is a fairly common one, used by many even today to explain suffering. There are many people, though, who are uncomfortable with the concept, partially because life experiences show that even righteous people sometimes suffer, despite not having sinned. Rav Chasdai Kreskes, for example, whose own community was decimated in the Spanish pogroms of 1391 and their aftermath, goes out of his way to say that the Israelites in Egypt were innocent of all sin and suffered only afflictions of love. He thus attempts to comfort his compatriots, telling them that the long exile and suffering of Spanish Jewry is also not due to sins, but is designed to bring the nation closer to Hashem. Others similarly move away from the punitive approach, suggesting that the decree of bondage was educative in nature. Many thus point out how life in exile was critical for the formation of Israel's national identity and the prevention of assimilation. The 16th century Italian commentator Sforno and the 19th century German thinker Rev Hirsch assert that Yaakov's family, had they remained in Canaan, would have been assimilated into the surrounding nations. The nation was exiled to Egypt because there, the chances of assimilation were much smaller. Since the Egyptians were xenophobic, and would not even eat with the Hebrews, let alone marry them, it was not as likely that the people would acculturate there. And forced to live in Goshen, they could preserve their national identity. Rav Hirsch notes how later in history, ghettos continued to play the same role as Goshen, ensuring that the Jews remained distinct and did not assimilate. The 19th century Lithuanian commentator Nitziv moves in a similar direction, but focuses on the second stage of the narrative, the oppression, and its utility in combating assimilation. In contrast to Sforno, he asserts that it was first in Egypt that the children of Israel began to assimilate, and that it was anti-Semitism which proved to be their salvation. The need for the bondage arose specifically because the Israelites did not remain in Goshen, but tried to acculturate into general Egyptian society. The enslavement was a remedy, curbing assimilation as the Israelites were relegated to undesirable status. The Nitziv too draws historical parallels to his own day and concludes that the root cause of anti-Semitism throughout the generations is the Jewish desire to assimilate and be accepted in non-Jewish society. And each time that they attempt to join surrounding society, the result is non-acceptance and even persecution, the most successful antidote to acculturation. Rav Hirsch further views the tribulations of exile as a vehicle for not only religious growth, but also for societal and interpersonal maturation. He claims that both the Egyptian and the current exiles resulted from jealousy and class distinctions. Yaakov's preferential treatment of Yosef and the differences in status between the sons of his primary wives and those of his maidservants led to family strife. Similar sectarian divisions have plagued Judaism ever since. Anti-Semitism, though, is blind to such divisions, and it serves as the great equalizer, promoting unity and forging common experiential bonds among all Jews. A final variation of the adjudicative approach is taken by Nechama Leibowitz, who emphasizes the aspect that the enslavement was meant to teach the Israelites an important lesson in empathy. By experiencing exile and slavery themselves, the children of Israel learn to feel and care for the downtrodden and less fortunate members of society. She points out how the Torah references the Egyptian exile and redemption in numerous commandments which deal with social justice. Today, in fact, the Exodus has become a global symbol of liberty, justice, and human rights. However, it's difficult to say that the Torah is implying that this was the purpose of the exile and slavery, rather than a lesson that can be derived in retrospect. It would seem that empathy could have been taught in a less painful way. Moreover, it's unclear if those who have not experienced slavery firsthand and only experience it via one's national memory are more sensitive to the issue than any other. To summarize, many view the exile and bondage as punishment for sin, blaming either Avraham for exhibiting a lack of faith, the brothers for the sale of Yosef, or the Israelites in Egypt for assimilating and worshipping idols. Others prefer to suggest that the experience was necessary to help forge the nation's character, keeping them from assimilating into outside cultures, promoting equality and brotherhood within, and molding its ethos of social justice. As often happens when hardship befalls either an individual person or the nation as a whole, we can never know for certain what is the cause or goal of the suffering. Perhaps then, the question we should really be asking is not only why the event happened, but what we can learn from the experience and how we can use it to improve ourselves or help others. For more on this topic and other topics related to Pesach or the Haggadah, please visit alatorah.org.